All the time. Pastor. Welcome to Going Deeper. Welcome to everybody who joins us online and to our CM and our Millstadt campus. We are at the tail end of signups for our pilgrimage to Israel and Egypt. You have till the 31st of August. There's some information that is out on the Sync Center. If you would like information and none's available, give the office a call. If God's pinging you, we still have a little bit of room on the trip. It feels like to me we've got about four or five spots left. And so just pray about that. Also want to give some recommendations on books. I'm often asked for recommendations. For those of you who are students of the Bible, this book by Simon Sebag Montefiore it's called Jerusalem, the Biography. It's written, the guy's a brilliant writer. It's written like a biography, except rather than on an individual, it's on a city. And it's the best book of its kind I think I've come across. So I would heartily recommend that, particularly if you are planning to make a Holy Land trip someday. But Jerusalem runs throughout the Bible. It just runs throughout the Bible. It's in the early Old Testament. It's in the middle Old Testament. It's in the New Testament. Jerusalem is the city. It's considered the city of God. I really, really like that book and just encourage you to dive in a little bit. If you read a truly great novel, it doesn't really matter who wrote it. The work stands for itself. A great literary work gives credibility to the author. Many a writer has put themselves on the map by writing a defining masterpiece. I recently discovered that the average book in the United States of America, published by one of the top seven publishers in this country, sells 500 copies. The average book in America, published by one of the seven top publishers, sells an average of 500 copies. What drives the industry? There are a handful of authors who sell millions and millions and millions of books every time they release one. And the other ones, they're hoping one of those becomes the next million book seller. I think there are a handful of writers, and you may have these people in your world if you read a lot. You just know they've proven themselves. They've got a track record. Anything they write, you're just going to buy. I know those of you that are music people. There are some bands I just like. And it doesn't matter. I don't need to hear a new release. I just get it. And a writer is very much the same way. I was a fan of the late James Michener. He wrote carefully researched historical novels, some of which are actually longer than the Bible. The Source remains my personal favorite novel of all time of its genre. It is a fictitious, but it is a history of Israel. Anything Michener published in his lifetime, I would buy sight unseen. And anything I found out that he had previously published that I was not aware of, I would buy sight unseen. I can't tell you how many Michener books Melissa brought home for me. I loved all of them. It's only among the most gifted and celebrated writers does the author give credibility to the novel. That happens a fraction of the time. Now, I want you to contrast this with a book that was on how to avoid common mistakes that people make in personal finances and investment. And let's imagine it's written by somebody you've never heard of. I mean, just somebody you haven't heard of at all. Before you read that book, wouldn't you want to know something about the author? I mean, I'd want to know something a whole lot more than they had a PhD from somewhere. I know a lot of PhDs who are POOR, and I don't want to read their thoughts on investments. You know, for me, at the very least, I'd want to know that the author of that book, I'd want to know the state of their personal finances. I would want to know how their investments were doing before they're going to give me advice. Were Jude a literary masterpiece, it really wouldn't matter who wrote it. But it's not. It's not a work that stands on its own. It's a spiritual warning written to a specific first century audience. So frankly, the credibility of the author matters a great deal. Who writes the warning matters a great deal with this type of literature. I can easily imagine a first century reader getting a hold of one of the manuscripts of Jude, and there were probably gazillions of manuscripts of Jude that were out there. Remember, they didn't have copy machines. They didn't even have the Gutenberg press. You had to hand copy letters. Why would this one get hand copied easily? It's short. These would have been out there. The other reason is because the Greek is so good. It's really easy to translate something that is well written. And it's well written. But I can imagine somebody getting a hold of this letter and they start diving into this. And I mean, this letter's radiating at pretty high frequencies. I can just imagine them thinking, who is Jude? Who is Jude? Well, that's actually a fair question. Jude contains 619 words. It was written by Jude, the youngest half-brother of Jesus, for the purpose of defending the Christian faith. Jude is the English form of the Greek Judas, which derives from the Hebrew Judah. It was a common name in Israel. In fact, Jesus had two Judases in his batch of disciples. Judah, Jude, common names, all variants of one another. Last week, I explained how false teachers and false teachings had breached the borders of the early church. To use Jude's colorful language, they wormed in. They wormed in. Anybody ever have an apple orchard or a fruit orchard? The worms sort of worm in. Writers like Paul and Peter and Jude know that unless strong action is taken in response to a hostile theological incursion, the Christian movement itself is going to be in significant jeopardy. Jude was written in excellent Greek. It reflects a distinctively Jewish worldview. It utilizes both biblical and non-biblical sources to make its point, and that is sort of the problem for us. The non-biblical sources are sources with which we are simply not familiar. But Jude refers to them as familiarly as he would telling a Bible story. So the non-biblical sources that he uses to illustrate his points are kind of baffling to a lot of modern readers. And because if you just sit down and read Jude, it seems to be all over the place. It sort of makes Jude feel a little untrustworthy. As I like to say, part of Jude looks like he just took it out of yesterday's newspaper, and part of Jude looks like he took it out of yesterday's newspaper on another planet. So we're going to address all that in the week to come. You're going to own Jude by time we are done. I date the composition of Jude earlier than 1st and 2nd Peter. I like somewhere in the mid-50s AD, could be later. But one thing is really certain, 2nd Peter relies heavily on Jude. People will sometimes ask me, they'll say, why is 1st Peter so calm and pastoral and 2nd Peter radiates so much? I said, Peter read Jude. Jude will get you wound up. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Peter read Jude. This is not the letter Jude wanted to write. He wanted to write a letter celebrating the faith. Instead, he's going to end up defending it. But we do not get to choose our times, do we? We do not get to choose our times. We only get to choose as to whether we will be faithful in our times. Verse 1. This letter is from Jude, a slave of Jesus Christ and a brother of James. I am writing to all who have been called by God the Father, who loves you and keeps you safe in the care of Jesus Christ. So with this introduction, Jude humbly introduces himself as a slave of Jesus Christ. The Greek word is doulos. Some people translate it servant or bond servant. Maybe in American history, we might say even indentured servant. But I'm just going to be real honest with you. The word translates slave. It translates slave. And just because we don't like the connotations of the word slave, I certainly do not like the connotations of that word. It doesn't mean that Jude didn't use it. And it doesn't mean he didn't mean it. In the Roman Empire, slaves were the property of a master. They existed to do the bidding of the master. They operated under the authority of the master. But most of all, they couldn't quit. They couldn't quit. And that being said, some slaves, like tutors to the rich and famous, high-level household administrators and business administrators, and drumroll please, if you're watching the History Channel's Colosseum, gladiators were actually well compensated as slaves. They made awfully good money as slaves. A lot of them made enough money, they eventually bought their freedom. They eventually bought their freedom. Some slaves, like Spartacus, it's still a household word 2,000 years later. You say, well, we don't use it in our household. Well, perhaps you don't. Roughly 15% of the population of the Roman Empire was enslaved. Slavery was not always permanent. There were lots of ways to get yourself enslaved, but the easiest way was to lose in battle. To lose in battle, that was the easiest way. The designation of a Christian leader as a slave to Christ is not unique to Jude. Both Peter and Paul refer to themselves as doulos, slaves to Jesus Christ. It's kind of hard for us to get our heads around, but I will tell you this. I run into pastors and church leaders sometime who are really discouraged in ministry these days. And let me tell you, that's not hard. It was hard before COVID. And the world's been about three quarters unstable since COVID. It's just really tough for a lot of Christian leaders. And the first thing I ask them when they start sharing with me about how discouraged they are, I'll say, did God call you? You say, well, do you let them talk first? Heavens, no, I don't have all day. Did God call you? And if they say yes, I say, then you were drafted. You can't quit. You can be released, but you can't quit. And if you weren't called, you just chose a crappy profession. You need to own it. You need to own it. Were you called? I really think what Jude is talking about is something like that. If you're called, you can't quit. If God asks you to do it, you're going to have to get it done. Jude also denotes himself as the biological brother of James. Jude doesn't claim to be a half-brother of Jesus, and he doesn't want that status implied in any way. To be honest with you, being the half-brother of Jesus feels like a lot of pressure, doesn't it? 100 years ago, I was asked to do a revival in a little town called Noble, Illinois. I was driving into Noble. I think I lived here in my early years. I was driving into Noble for like a three-night revival. And I drove into the convenience store in Noble. And in the convenience store, there was like a flyer. It was made from perhaps the world's worst Xerox machine. But I could tell in some way, shape, or form, it had once been a photograph of me. And it said at the top, revival, really, really big. And then it said, God's man of power for the hour, healings each evening. I almost got in my car and drove home. Talk about pressure.
to introduce yourself as the brother of Jesus would really not cause problems to Christians today. We would probably appreciate it because it lets us know for sure who Jude was. But to introduce yourself as the brother of Jesus back then would have caused all kinds of problems. It just would have caused all kinds of problems. So it's kind of interesting that what would not cause problems to the church today would cause problems to the church in Jude's time. Slaves of Christ, it's a pretty easy sell in the early church. Today, translators like it so little, they'll do a bad translation to keep from having to say it. James would have been the oldest of Mary and Joseph's biological children. He's now the well-known leader of the Jerusalem church. We also know that neither he nor Jude were believers during Jesus' lifetime. And I think that shouldn't be lost on us. Neither he nor Jude were believers during Jesus' lifetime. And you got to say, okay, what's up with that? To be honest with you, the resurrection is up with that. The resurrection is up with that. Why would James and Jude possibly convert to Christianity after the crucifixion of Christ? Because they saw him alive. Why did the people in the early New Testament church, in the immediate aftermath of the crucifixion, why are there so many Christians beginning to form? Because they see Jesus alive. They saw him die, and then they saw him living. That is pretty powerful evidence. And it was powerful enough to convince Jesus' half-brothers that he was indeed the promised Messiah of God. So I think as we look at this, claiming to be a brother of Jesus was too much, but claiming to be a brother of James is kind of a helpful name drop if you want people to read your book. I went 3 years without reading a single book that a publisher didn't ask me to read and then write a blurb on. You guys know those blurbs on the back covers? I went 3 years. I'm sitting there one day, I thought, I haven't read anything I wanted to for 3 years because I'm reading this and then I have to say like a whole sentence about it. And fortunately, some of those books are really, really good. But in a sense, Jude uses James to kind of endorse his book. That connection endorses his book. And it ensures that it's going to reach the widest audience possible. That being said, James' ultimate authority is based in his calling and the truth of his claims, not his connections and not his credentials. I need you to hear something. As baptized Christians, you are authorized to do ministry. You're authorized to do ministry. You say, well, do I need a seminary degree? Some of the worst ministers I've ever met have seminary degrees. I'm just saying we need to realize it's the calling of God upon our lives that equips us for ministry. I'm not anti-intellectual at all. I believe that we should study, and I believe we should work hard and get as good as we can possibly get. But it's not our studying that qualifies us for ministry. It's not what we do that qualifies us for ministry. It is the call of God that qualifies us for ministry. So if you get a ping, you're qualified. You get a ping, you're qualified. God would not have given you the ping if he didn't feel you had the stuff to see it through. So Jude writes on the authority of his calling. He writes on the truth of his claims. And he really pivots. He was going to write about how cool Christianity is. Wouldn't that be fun? The Jesus happy book. And now he's going to have to write on something else. He pivots because God asked him to pivot. He writes because God asked him to write. He warns because God asked him to warn. The second Jude completed this book and handed it off. His part in this was over. He had been faithful to God, and whatever people do with that is up to them. And I can really relate to that. I spend about, I'd say 75% of my time preparing this message and Sunday messages. All I can do is, under the power and the influence of the Holy Spirit, is use what gifts God has given me, do the hard work, and give you the very best I have. Now, the second I deliver it, I'm done. Because I've been faithful to what God asked me to do. I'm done. What people do with that's up to you. But my part is concluded. So Jude, in the writing of this, when he hits that final period, he's been faithful. Now it goes out, and let God do what God will. Whereas many pastoral letters in the New Testament are addressed to individuals or specific churches, the intended audience here is really addressed a whole lot more widely. I mean, I thought about this. James could have said, "I write to all believers," and then it occurred to me that would make the letter even shorter. So I get it. He kind of spreads this out just a little bit. But given the sensibilities that I'm bringing into Jude, given the time period, given my claim of the authorship of Jude, I think Jude's primary audience is roughly going to be the exact same audience to which 1 Peter was addressed. And what we're really talking about, here's Jerusalem, okay? Here's Jerusalem. So we're talking about the province of Syria, the province of Cappadocia. So we're going up and just a little bit over. Now, what's really important here is you have some major, major cities. You have Jerusalem, you have Damascus, you have Antioch, which probably had the largest church in the ancient world. Probably the largest concentration of Christians at the time of this writing were in Antioch. And then you had Tarsus. What's Tarsus famous for? The home of Paul, right? There's got to be a billboard out front. Tarsus, home of the Apostle Paul, right? So this is really who is being addressed here. I can tell you, in the fall of 2024, our next pilgrimage, we're going to do a pilgrimage that's going to cover this area and Greece. So our pilgrimage will be to Asia Minor, and it will be to Greece. We're going to go into modern Istanbul. We are going to head over to Cappadocia. We're going to ride hot air balloons over the most beautiful mountains in Asia. Then we are going to slide under here. We're going to trace the ancient mail route that actually we know as the letters to the churches as recorded in Revelation. And then we're going to head up and see the incredible ruins of Ephesus, Pergamum. Then we're going to fly down to Athens as if we didn't have enough fun already. And we'll go to Athens and Corinth. So that is kind of our next pilgrimage. This is really Jude's audience right here. If you really look at this, Jude's audience is really not defined by where people live. It's defined by what people believe and what people practice. And if I said, who is this specifically addressed to? I would say the kept and the filled. The kept and the filled. Let's look at the addressees of Jude. Number one, it's addressed to all who have been called by God. The Greek word translated called does not mean to invite or choose or select. It is not like an invitation to a wedding. You get an invitation to a wedding, you can respond to it or not. You can just let it set if you wish. It's just an invitation. This word in Greek isn't a take it or leave it kind of concept. It's really a lot closer to summons or draft in a legal sense or subpoena in a political sense. This is a call from God that demands a response. It's not a take it or leave it kind of thing. So it's all who have been called by God. Secondly, it's addressed to all who are loved by God. The Greek is even tougher here. But the English translation of this whole kind of idea, my best shot at it would be those who walk in the love of God. Not those loved by God, that's everybody. This is not written to everybody. This is written to those who walk in the love of God. Those who are abiding in God's love. Those who are walking in fellowship with God. Those who are practicing Christians, if you will. The third category is all who are kept safe by God in the care of Christ. Translation, tricky again. But the text refers to Christians who, by the grace of God, have held on to the unadulterated and true Christian faith. They have held on to the true faith. False teachers are trying to pollute it. This is written to those who have refused to have their faith polluted, those who have not given in to fleshly desires, who have not been enticed by false teachers, who have not succumbed to false teaching. This is a book written to those who have kept the faith. As those, let me say this another way. This is a book less written to those who kept the faith and more written to those who have been kept by the faith. If you hold on to the pure Christian faith, you haven't so much kept it, it's kept you. It's the true faith that keeps us from false teaching. It's the true faith that keeps us from false teachers. It's the true faith that keeps us from immorality. The faith keeps us. It keeps us. So Jude, who really has this affinity for lists of three, we're going to see a few of those. But believe it or not, we're already in verse 2. May God give you more and more mercy, peace, and love. And I know what you're thinking. There's no way we can get any further than that, possibly. May God give you more and more mercy, peace, and love. This is a petition that God would grant those who are called, loved, and kept by Christ to ever-increasing amounts of mercy, peace, and love. Why? Because this is stuff we all are going to need. I'm going to suggest to you that no matter how sharp your witnessing technique is, and no matter how much boldness and courage you have, if you don't have mercy, peace, and love, you're not going to be an effective evangelist. You're just not going to be an effective evangelist. I'm not saying somebody won't pray with you to get rid of you. I'm just saying you're not going to be a very effective evangelist. If we are to lead winsome, effective, abundant, multiplying Christian lives, especially in difficult times, we need more mercy, more peace, more love than we currently have. You want to pray a prayer God wants to answer? Start praying for more mercy, more peace, and more love. Guarantee you that's a prayer God wants to answer. Who doesn't want to be filled with those things? Who doesn't want to be around people filled with those things? There's just no downside. So now, in this prayer for filling, let's kind of unpack this. What does it mean to be filled with mercy? This refers to compassion that goes somewhere. Not a noun, a verb. How often do we get emotionally moved by something, but we stop short of a response? To use my vernacular, have you ever been a ping whiffer? You get the ping, and you just don't make contact when you swing the bat at it. You just whiff. You feel it, but you don't act upon it. This isn't that. This is give us more of compassion that goes somewhere. Give us more ability to follow through on the pings. Give us more action in response to those promptings you give us. Mercy refers to the holy concern that leads toward action. It's the action that leads toward evangelism, and it's evangelism that leads others toward conversion. We share the faith, not out of duty, guilt, or obligation. We share the faith because we truly love people. And that's one thing I think we need to ask ourselves as we reach out to the world? Do we truly love people? Do we truly love people? You're never going to be an effective evangelist if deep in your heart you think you're better than other people. We all need more mercy. We all need more of that. Number two, those who are filled with peace. This refers not to the peace of God so much as to those who have found peace in God. All right, I'm going to say it one more time. It refers not so much to the peace of God than it refers to those who have found peace in God. People of the Old Testament Israel were surrounded by hills and deserts and mountains. Those of you who've been to Israel with me, if you haven't, just look up the Judean wilderness. I mean, you have to, it makes you thirsty just looking at the pictures. It is so dry, so mountainous. But what really happened throughout antiquity is is it okay if I draw an air map? You sort of have the Mesopotamian superpowers over here, and then they would come up over the Fertile Crescent, and normally they were going to fight the Egyptians who lived down here, and the battlegrounds were always in Israel. Israel was just this big battleground. Every now and then somebody'd come and get Israel because they wanted like the Jezreel Valley that grew good crops and stuff, but for the most part, places like Megiddo, crossroads on trade routes, they were just battlegrounds. And so you had all of these conflicts that happened there over and over again. Now, in these times, you lived in a village, you lived in a city. Most of them did not have walls. Nobody really had armies. And so you see marauders coming, you see an army marching through. What did people do? Well, you sure didn't stand and try to protect your house. That's a good way to end up D-E-A-T, debt. They're gonna kill you. You don't stand there against an army. And you don't tell them they can't have stuff. You take everything you can carry and you flee to the hills. And the hills come conveniently equipped with tons of caves. Tons of caves. There's caves everywhere. And the people would hide in the caves. And when the armies passed through, normally speaking, they weren't there to hunt everybody down. Now, the Romans, after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, were out there to hunt everybody down. But normally, that didn't happen. Syrians, the Persians, that group of people, they didn't hunt people down. They're just marching through. They need a place to fight. If you're in their way, they're going to kill you. So you stay in the mountains until they all pass through. People fled to the mountains. They found peace in the mountains. In the mountains, they found safety, and in safety, they found peace. This describes the incomprehensible peace that comes to those who walk with God, who abide with God, who find their protection in God. If you have something happening that's disturbing your peace or threatening to disturb your peace, run to the mountains. Run to the mountains. Find your protection in God. Find your peace in God. We all need more of that. And then the third thing is they're filled with love. We need to be filled with love. This denotes those who have been filled to the brim by God's love for them. This isn't how much we love God. This is how much God loves us. Love is how we forgive those who have hurt us. Love is how we hang in with those who have disappointed us. Love is how we remain hopeful when everything else around us seems to be blowing apart. You know, we're all full of something and we all leak. Can I just hear an amen from somebody? If you're filled with anger, you're going to leak anger. If you're filled with fear, you're going to leak fear. If you're filled with pride, you're going to leak pride. But if you're filled with love, guess what you leak? Love. If you're filled with love, you leak love. Isn't that awesome? So if you got to be filled with something and you're going to leak something, love. That's awesome. Love splashes over. Jude instructs us to get filled with love so we can leak love. We all need more of that. as we take a look seriously at who this letter is written to, I think the first thing it's going to hit us is that this letter, maybe more than any other letter in the Bible, is directly written to us. It's not addressed to people who live here or there. It's not addressed to people who live in a certain time. It's addressed to all who have been called by God, us, who have been loved by God, us, who have been kept by God in the care of Christ, us, and to these, us, to do what God's asked us to do, stand tall and contend for the Christian faith in difficult times. He is praying for us as we contend for God that we will have more mercy, more peace, and more love. That's his prayer for us. More mercy, more peace, and more love. As we press down this trail in the weeks to come, I want you to fully embrace the idea that Jude has written to us. It's directly addressed to us. You know, Paul might write a letter and he addresses it to the Corinthians and then he mentions names. And it's real easy to say, well, that's not us. We don't live in Corinth. My name's not that. But this isn't written to a place. It's not written to a person. It's written to a people. And it's not just written to a people who existed way back then. It's written to people who exist right now. If we can get a hold of the message of this letter, we not only will find ourselves strong defenders of the Christian faith, but we will find ourselves credible evangelists for Jesus Christ. And that's my goal. Sometimes I see Jude presented and it seems like it's presented in such a way as to get everybody. I don't know about you, but when I look at fights, the mad guy usually loses. I tell people all the time, I'm a traditional Bible-believing Christian, but I'm not in a bad mood about it. I'm going to stand for the Christian faith. I'm not wavering. Not backing down, not going anywhere, but I'm not in a bad mood about it. I'm going to keep a smile on my face, song in my heart, a little pep in my step. And I think Jude's going to equip us all to do that. I think one of the worst witnesses out there today is the abundance of Christians who have a chip on their shoulder. It just makes it too easy for the world to dismiss us. Even if you're right. It makes it too easy for the world to dismiss us. What if we could stand for biblical truth in a spirit of Christ-like love? Seems like I've heard that before.